Happy New Year to all Western Bubble listeners. We know it's already February when you're listening to this episode, but that's the luxury that we take. We have a bit of a break. And boy, what a break that was. My name is Dario Hasenstab. I'm here with Balder Hagritz, and we're back with the Western Bubble podcast. I think a badly needed podcast in the January that we've had in 2025. Balder, today we're talking about U.S. foreign policy under Donald Trump, or kind of policy in general under Donald Trump. Why are we talking about this topic today?
Well, the United States, like it or not, is still the most influential, powerful country in the world. And it's got now a president that clearly is doing things very differently than other presidents have done in the past. Even is doing things differently than his first presidency in 2017. And so it is important to analyze the consequences of that. The first couple of weeks of the Trump presidency are going by very, very fast, with enormous consequences and changes for the way the country positions itself on the world stage.
Yeah, there's so many things happening. I'm having personally a tough time keeping up with all the presidential decrees that he's issuing on so many different paths of life. And it's also really difficult to keep up with the consequences of that, because I don't think anyone in the administration knows the consequences, and I don't think anyone else knows the consequences until 2-3 days later. Suddenly you little news items start popping up of, there are now vegetables rotting in fields because workers are no longer showing up to the fields, because the president ordered basically police forces to go to just farm fields and start investigating whether people there might be illegal immigrants.
And on top of that, the actual long-term consequences are probably even more important to look at, in the sense that in international relations, action today, certainly for a powerful country like the United States, has all kinds of consequences for the next decade, the next 20, 30, 40 years, that are very difficult to predict right now, but clearly are there. The United States now is still being affected by decisions that were made in the early 21st century.
I mean, we've talked about this in the first Trump presidency in a past episode, where we looked at some of the decisions he had taken in the past, right? Like pulling out of Syria very rapidly, and already pointing out the long-term dynamics there. And I think we can observe a lot of these long-term dynamics that we've looked at already. Today, we want to focus on the next 4 years. And so first, we're going to look at domestic consequences, because those are hugely influential, right, to foreign policy, because whatever is happening to the United States as a country has influence over how much power the United States can exert internationally. Then we want to look at specific foreign policy initiatives, right? For example, invading Canada. And then at the end, what does it mean to defund just different departments or different just complete like strains of government? In the end, Balder, I want to ask you whether it is more or less likely that the United States is going to war now under this Trump presidency. But let's start with domestic consequences. One of the most shocking things to me is how little resistance there is to anything that Trump is doing right now. Because 8 years ago, during the first 4 years of Trump, the moment he tried to sign a decree, right, there was immediate outcry. There were immediately things which were being challenged in front of like courts. The media was very like already looking at the consequences, or like trying to predict the consequences, trying to lobby against any of that. I'm missing a lot of this in 2025. It doesn't really seem like there is that same backlash to this Trump presidency than there was 8 years ago.
Indeed, and this is essentially a surrendering, a kind of giving up by a lot of forces within the United States, and basically bending over backwards to Trump to please him, to make sure that you can still do business with him and not to antagonize him, coming from a certain place of fear. And that is particularly important for a country like the United States, because the United States, love them or hate them, they've always had a enormous plurality of voices in their policymaking. The United States is known to be self-critical, is a country that is known to have a balance of powers. The president is powerful, but not that powerful. Whereas if you look at a country like China, Xi Jinping, it's harder to distinguish Xi from the Chinese people. It's harder to distinguish the Chinese people from the Chinese state because there is not this very active, lively debate visible to the outside world. In the United States, there's always been this inherent criticism against powers that be. And the fact that now what we're seeing, exactly as you're describing, is a lack of that opposition means a radical change in the way that the United States operates domestically and towards the rest of the world and how the rest of the world views that. I think Europeans are shocked by how little Americans are actually standing up against some of the extreme aspects of the current Trump administration. And therefore, the United States as a country is more likely to be blamed for some of the upcoming failures that will undoubtedly happen. Whereas in the past, you would say, oh, it's just crazy Trump, but the United States overall is still okay. No, no, now they seem to go hand in hand. And that is very, very dangerous.
Is that because the United States has turned into an oligarchy? There are articles saying that. That's basically, it's now a country run by Elon Musk, the true president of the United States.
You say that with a face of slight sarcasm and a tone of slight sarcasm. I actually have quite a bit of sympathy for this argument of oligarchy in the sense that not that the United States is necessarily an oligarchy now. It's always very difficult to draw a line. When does democracy stop being a democracy? When does it become something else? But the very fact that during the inauguration, you had this whole row of business leaders, not just business leaders, owners, billionaires, Musk, Zuckerberg, all the others, Bezos, all lining up at Trump's feet and saying, we're going to work together now, was absolutely new. If you look at history, certainly US history, but history in general, rich people, powerful people have from society have always had an enormous impact on policymaking. That's not something new. But in the 1990s, Bill Gates had to go through the back door of the White House to talk to the Clinton administration. Gates was, as a founder of Microsoft, was powerful, still is powerful, but there was an understanding that you didn't want to make it too explicit. You didn't want to give a feeling that billionaires were running the government. For a number of reasons, because that is oligarchy by definition. That is what an oligarchy would look like. And so you want to at least pretend to still have some kind of democratic foundations in the way that you go about it. And so now in 2025, having all those billionaires lined up very openly, very blatantly, and immediately changing their company's policies according to the wishes of the Trump administration, is essentially saying to the world, we don't care about liberal democracy anymore. We are happy to go down this oligarchic route. And that has obviously enormous consequences because the United States' identity on the world stage has always been one of defending liberal democracy. And that is now completely out of the window.
We already talked about this a little bit before the election. So last year, when Bezos decided that the Washington Post was not going to state a preference for either of the two candidates, right? There was this huge kind of controversy that has happened. And I remember thinking, oh, why is he doing that? Right? I mean, it doesn't even look that good for Trump at the moment. Maybe he knew something that we didn't know, or he was just preemptively careful. So with Bezos, it doesn't really seem like him rolling over that much, right? It more seemed like a strategic decision. Right, that's just what it seems like. But Zuckerberg, on the other hand, how sad is that man? Right, I mean, there's also been this visual change about him from going from this weird, like tech-looking guy to now this broification of himself. Right, where he's looking like a bro. Right, one of those US guys, more or less, and completely switching. Right, going basically doing a 180. And now going into the completely other direction, basically just following in line with Elon Musk.
No, and I think that is so. Every billionaire has their own motivations, has their own personality, but the fact that they are happy to be there at the inauguration, that visibly, not in the background, not you know, but visibly on the front row, even in front of cabinet members, right? You would think, hey, if you have an inauguration, you want to put your ministers, secretary of state and all that in front of everyone else. No. The billionaires are happy to be there in front and the Trump administration is happy to have them there in front. It shows how the world is moving away from basic principles and basic foundations, that there's no pretense anymore, right? And as we've said very often, Trump in itself is not the reason for this change. The change has been coming for a long time, and Trump is in many ways a symptom, but it's now become a very blatant expression of this change. And so in many ways, as I will argue later on when we discuss specific foreign policy, it's a bit of, I would argue that at a foreign policy level, it's a bit of a mixed bag for the world. There is a bit of, there are some negative consequences to the Trump administration, but also some potentially positive consequences. But if I were a US citizen, and if I were to believe in the basic foundations and the basic principles of my country as laid down by the founding fathers and then slowly improved upon over time, then I would have sleepless nights. I would be extremely worried about the direction that the country is taking.
And this direction that the country is taking is not, well, it's not helping the United States with its foreign policy, right? Because the United States is, with this, is not going to become more powerful in the world.
No, and I think this is exactly why for the rest of the world, it's a bit of a mixed bag. But for US citizens, it's terrible news, because the foreign policy steps that the United States is taking right now, at least the exclamations, at least the statements, because we have to see what of it becomes real and what of it is just hot air. A lot of it will be just hot air. But the steps that are taken are actively hurting the position of the United States under a smokescreen of let's make America great again, sort of almost imperial US. Let's expand literally our borders. Let's make sure that we become bigger and more powerful. The United States is actually losing some of its strongest weapons. As we've said often in the past, the reason why the United States has become so successful as a country in the 20th century that basically dominated global politics, basically could decide global politics from the White House, is not because of the size of its borders, is not because of the size of its military. It is because it was actually seen as a city upon a hill. It was seen as a country that, for all its flaws and all its dramatic mistakes, the Vietnam War, anything else that you can look at in its past, it was seen as a country that was hopeful and that was actually legitimately claiming some kind of moral leadership around the world. And now that is something that the Trump administration has completely given up on. And they're just saying, we're going to protect the interest of Americans, America first. But in doing so, paradoxically, they're worsening the position of Americans because they lose that edge over other countries. The United States can no longer claim to be any different from Russia, from China, from anyone else, because they're essentially saying, no, we have our interest and the rest of the world can go, and I was just going to say a bad word, go F themselves.
Yeah, go love themselves.
Exactly. Go love themselves.
To quote Ed Sheeran, exactly. Well, let's look at some specific foreign policy initiatives, because I mean, saying or stating publicly that you, as the president of the most powerful country in the world, have an interest in invading Canada, or basically making Canada the 51st state of the United States, taking Greenland, or taking control of the Panama Canal. I remember, I mean, for me, this is exactly the reason why, on a far removed level, I love listening to Trump. Right? If he was just a character that had no power whatsoever, I think he would be one of the best comedians in the world, because those things are just inherently funny to me. But the fact that the most powerful man in the world, right, the president of the most powerful country in the world, is saying these things is really scary and worrying, right? And as you said, we don't know yet to what degree he will actually pursue this. But yeah, we could look at a situation where Donald Trump starts a special military operation into Canada to liberate them from Justin Trudeau.
Yeah, so I mean, even the statement itself, I mean, let's face it, that military operation is not going to happen in Canada. I mean, it might happen elsewhere, but not towards Canada. Canada is slightly too big for that and slightly too opposed to give up its universal healthcare system. But the very statement is already incredibly damaging from the United States perspective, because it signals to Canada, hang on, we don't have your back anymore. This agreement of being friendly neighbors and you, Canada, being slightly the polite version of us. And often in the past, Canada has formulated US policy in ways that was more acceptable to the rest of the world. That is now gone. And Canadians hearing this know this. And Canadians will now look for alliances elsewhere. They will, for example, start looking at Britain, post-Brexit Britain. Hey, can we do some business? Because we are not sure if the United States is still this reliable partner, which from a US perspective is terrible, terrible news. You lose your leadership position. You lose your comparative advantage over China in all of this. Why would you ever want to do this? So even though obviously Canada is not going to be annexed by the United States, it's not going to become the 51st state of the United States, the very statement itself is deeply, deeply damaging to US foreign policy. Now, if you want to have an even worse example, you have to look at Greenland, of course.
Well, I mean, hey, Greenland, according to Trump and Trump Jr., right, all 50,000 people want to become US citizens. I mean, why wouldn't you? It's the greatest country on earth, of course. Right. I mean, apart from the fact that it is under basically the protection of Denmark. But now the question I'm asking in reverse is who wants to be under the protection of Denmark, right?
But also, I think you're understating it with protection of Denmark. Yes, it's a protectorate of Denmark. But in UN terms, that means that it's still Westphalian territory of Denmark, right? So it's not just like a country that somehow is supported by Denmark. No. Greenland does not have any independence yet. Now, what is true is that there has been, and we're talking about 50,000 people, that is nothing. That is, you know, for such a huge landmass, that is absolutely, negligible. Those 50,000 people among themselves in their little town hall or their little local pub or wherever they discuss things, and I apologize for anyone from Greenland who feels offended by this, but I'm sorry, you're just tiny.
I don't apologize.
They have decided that maybe independence is a good idea. And you can see the thinking there. This is one of those typical situations. 50,000 people sitting on all this these natural resources. Oh, that can become very economically interesting. But it's Denmark who decides whether Greenland becomes independent or not. And there was an opinion poll among those 50,000. Basically, an opinion poll there is asking everyone around. And it was very clear that something, I would have to check this again, but something like 80-85% said, no, we don't want to become part of the United States. Becoming independent is one thing. Becoming part of the United States is a completely different thing. Now, regardless of what the Trump administration does in the next few months or years towards Greenland, the very first consequence has already been directly visible. Denmark announced $2 billion military spending, extra spending on protecting Greenland. Protecting against whom? Protecting against the United States. This is a NATO ally. This is supposedly part of the closest military alliance that the world has ever seen. And that completely undermines US leadership around the world. Interesting question, Dario. Why does Denmark think that $2 billion is going to do anything given that they're facing the Pentagon with $850 billion and there's no way that Denmark with 2 or 10 or 20 billion could ever resist a military assault by the United States?
Careful, because you just triggered the my master's degree education in me. I'm going to give you the academic answer, and that's basically a tripwire investment. Is that the moment, right, you want to station some soldiers on there, and the moment the United States attacks, this triggers Article 42 of the Treaty of the European Union, and that will mean that all countries of the EU have to go to the defense of Denmark and go to war with the United States. Isn't that a great theoretical thought to have in 2025?
But it's complete insanity, right? So that's exactly it. So basically what Denmark wants to do is make sure that if the United States pulls any tricks, that at least they have to shoot some Danish soldiers. There's no pretense that Denmark could resist, but the moment the United States can't just walk into Greenland and plant a flag and say this is ours, but actually has to engage in some kind of even minor military operation, at that moment all hell breaks loose, exactly as you say, between Europe, also within NATO. Hold on, isn't now a NATO member being attacked? So does NATO now have to trigger the defense mechanism? It becomes chaos. And that's exactly what Denmark can hope for. And it shows how the United States would actually be deeply, deeply hurt by this.
Can you imagine a Turkish soldier being called to Greenland to basically fight on both sides. The listeners might not know this about us, but both of us really enjoy the comics of Asterix. And there is that one comic where basically the Romans start fighting each other, and they're confused themselves on which side are we actually on and why are we fighting each other.
Indeed, and they all look the same, and they talk to each other. Are you on my side or are you on the other side? And
this is what all of this is leading to. And I believe that, right, the way I'm reacting to this, right, to January 2025 with a lot of sarcasm is just my brain protecting itself from the reality we live in, because I think it's incomprehensible, the world we live in. But this is what it is, right? This is some theoretical scenario that if I had written an essay about this 5 years ago, I'm pretty sure most professors would have given me a very low grade for saying this is unrealistic. What are you dreaming about at night?
Yeah, and I absolutely, you mentioned 5 years ago, and you're absolutely right. But I can only reemphasize how wrong we were in the 1990s when thinking about the 21st century. How off we were in thinking what the evolution of global society would look like. And so I can only, going back to the practical side of this, even if nothing happens, because it's still, you know, I have to be careful with these things because weird things are happening all the time now. I still find it very difficult to believe that Trump will actually take any real action towards Greenland. But I'm not predicting that. I'm not making any predictions. I thought Brexit wouldn't happen. I'm fairly certain Canada won't be annexed by the United States. But, you know, with Greenland, there's more of a gray area. But even if the Trump administration backs off and doesn't do anything, the harm of Denmark having to invest $2 billion against the leader of NATO is absolutely disastrous for any Western alliance, for any kind of cooperation. And it means that in the future, the United States will be in real trouble if they actually expect NATO allies, Europeans, to actually support them diplomatically or economically or militarily.
Aren't we sure? Like, are we 100% certain that Donald Trump isn't just, to kind of quote Taylor Swift here, a mastermind? And this is actually him tricking Denmark into increasing their defense spending to finally meet the 2% target for NATO?
It's already gone from 2% to 5% now, right? The whole narrative. Except that I don't think Trump had in mind anti-American equipment and position taking in Greenland. But look, with Trump, you don't know. The thing is, politically, domestically, in the short term, it works for Trump. And Trump doesn't care about the long term, because 4 years from now, you know, he'll be gone. I mean, assuming that he doesn't radically alter the Constitution, right? Which is a whole different conversation. But Trump clearly cares about the politics of the moment. He's always been very clear about that. Also in his first presidency, it's about the here and now. It's not about the long term. And in the short term, this clearly politically works. Now, what is disturbing is that it has very significant long-term consequences that people around him might care about, right? This oligopoly, this complete reimagining of what the United States is supposed to be, that is something that sort of, I'm hesitant to use the word intellectual, but the intellectuals around him are dreaming of, and they might actually get it.
Exactly. I mean, these quote-unquote intellectuals, right? They might be dreaming of that. And another thing that I think they are really enjoying at the moment was this whole stunt with Colombia, right? With Trump basically sending two military airplanes full of migrants that are being deported to Colombia. The Colombian president rejecting this on the grounds that sending them over in military airplanes in chains is dehumanizing. And putting his foot down in a statement. And immediately Donald Trump threatening him to slap him with a 25% tariff that will go up by, I think it was 5 or 10% every day he doesn't take in those migrants, to the extent that then the Colombian business community started urging or demanding from their own president to, hey, let's get on board with this bully, because what else are we going to do? This is going to seriously cripple our economy.
Yeah, and so again, in the short term, you see, in this case, Colombia, a different country, a little bit like, you know, the billionaires that we've just mentioned, bending over to the will of Emperor Trump. In the long term, however, this is once again going to be very damaging to the United States, because it's again a signal, just like what we just said with Denmark, with Canada. Colombia now gets the signal, we have to be careful of this. We need to actually start looking elsewhere. It could open the door to China, to the European Union, to become much closer to Colombia, because this alliance that the Colombian government has had with the United States is now, if not broken, extremely fragile because of these stunts, right? So the thing to remember here, and the thing that I think gets under-highlighted, is that in the long run, the United States government is hurting the well-being of its own citizens. It's making its own position in the world worse. And American citizens are going to pay the price, because Colombia, Denmark, Canada, Panama, we haven't mentioned them yet, and just the European Union, everyone is now scrambling to say, okay, how do we deal with this? We cannot rely on Washington anymore. Let's start talking to each other. Let's start creating alliances without the United States.
Speaking of U.S. citizens paying the price, there's also talk of tariffs being imposed on Canada and Mexico. That's a fun idea, right? Because obviously, the moment you start imposing tariffs on Canada and Mexico to kind of, right, because it worked with Colombia, right? They ultimately, Colombia did what the United States wanted to do. So I'm sure that Canada is going to kind of cease to exist with this and hand over the keys basically to the United States.
First of all, very nice segue. Speaking of the citizens paying the price, I admire your ability to lead this conversation. So this is exactly the same problem. For a lot of this is based on ignorance, right? So the basic concept of tariffs being misunderstood by citizens, in this case, American citizens, they hear tariffs. And they think, in some case, literally, if you watch some videos, that somehow the Chinese government or the Canadian government or the Mexican government are going to pay for those tariffs. That's not how tariffs work. Tariffs puts up a barrier to cheap imports from outside, which means that those who American companies or American consumers who want to buy things from outside have to pay a higher price. It's not Mexico and Canada who pay it. It's the US companies, consumers who pay it. And as a result, things are going to get more expensive in the United States. Now, it also hurts Mexico and Canada because they can't export as easily anymore. But the money directly is being paid by Americans, right? The only argument that typically you have in for tariffs is that you want to protect certain industries. That typically is the case when your country is a developing country, where your country still needs to get a certain industrial base before it can open up its markets to the world. But nobody can argue that the United States is a developing country. It's the most advanced economy in the world, the biggest economy in the world, with the Chinese economy nearing. And so this idea that this is actually good for the American citizens, that is absolutely insane. That is just an ignorant belief. Now, will Mexico and Canada sort of give in? Maybe in the short term, because they want their export industry to still be able to enjoy the American market. But in the long run, once again, it will mean a realignment away from the United States. And there is the issue, and that goes also back to the flight to Colombia, of nobody is looking at the United States and sees it as a beacon of freedom or morality, right? Which was always the claim the United States made. Despite slavery, despite the behavior towards Native Americans, First Nation Americans, when European settlers arrived, the United States has always portrayed itself as the moral knights who can lead the world to a better tomorrow. Now, with this kind of behavior, nobody looks at the United States as a source of morality or an ethical compass that we can follow and that we somehow have to admire. Quite the opposite.
I want to compare this to the One Belt, One Road initiative by China. Because right when that was started, and also now in the years since, the main criticism from the West towards the One Belt, One Road initiative has always been that it's a debt trap, right? Oh yeah, China is going to build many great things, but they're going to employ Chinese citizens, right? The money is basically flowing then back into China, and it's just their way of trying to get control. And that was the criticism, right? Is that, oh, this is such bullying behavior. We really can't have this. You really shouldn't agree to this deal by China.
No, absolutely. And this is exactly the thing. So whereas previously the United States could still claim some kind of, I mean, fragile, as we've discussed over and over again, but some kind of moral superiority, that is completely gone now. The Belt and Road Initiative, in many ways, is simply building infrastructure with the permission and even with the often enthusiastic acceptance from local countries to make China the core, the driver behind the global economy, right? Going back to the Silk Road, the idea that the Chinese economy is the engine behind global dynamics. This is done on a mostly voluntary basis with governments all around the world. The United States is doing exactly the opposite, or is doing the same, but in a much worse version, namely forcing governments to cooperate without any sense of actual partnership. And that creates a world in which more and more countries are going to look towards the Belt and Road Initiative, are going to look towards China and say, hey, hang on, that's not that bad. I'd rather be economically protected by China than economically protected by this bully from Washington.
I was about to say, can you even say economically protected or economically bullied?
Yeah, no, that's exactly. So, and then people start saying, yes, but in China, human rights are being violated and all that. For your average citizen around the world, what's much more important is what is the well-being of your own society. And if China can guarantee that well-being in a friendlier, more cooperative way than the United States, then you will absolutely go down that route. And again, I cannot emphasize this enough, that is going to hurt American citizens.
And I mean, I don't even want to start talking about the protection of minorities in the United States under Donald Trump. But that's a topic for a different episode. The next kind of aspect I want to talk about is, right, Donald Trump is a businessman. Elon Musk is also a businessman. They really care about numbers. So, right, it came to no surprise that then they want to, have a small government, government's too big, and they basically slashed the budget for the development sector, right? Except for Egypt and Israel, because those two are useful, at least in Trump's mind. And it basically took 24 hours for the world to realize what that means. And suddenly, basically little red alarm lights started popping up all over the globe. Because the United States, is still the kind of leader of the world, because particularly because they're spending money to be that. And I think probably my favorite example is that ISIS prison in Syria, right? That's kind of maintained by the Kurds, and all the guards and basically the whole prison is financed by US aid. And they then realized very quickly that, hey, if we don't send money tomorrow, all of these people are going to desert, and 40,000 people, of whom not all of them are fighters, right? It's also families are basically imprisoned there. But all of them would walk free. And then very quickly, the transactional mind of Donald Trump said, okay, you know what? This prison gets to receive money, no one else.
Yeah, and then you're going to have a look at the next prison, at the next security initiative, at the next development initiative, and it becomes chaos. Now, what I would say is that this, of course, is incredibly destructive. Any textbook on good governance says, hey, you can change policy, but what you don't want to do is change policy overnight. You need spending that has already been planned, even if it's by your political adversaries, has to be respected in order for institutions and basic organizational relations to work properly. So, you know, to basically say from this moment on, from today on, all of a sudden we're going to stop all the spending is textbook bad governance. But that is symptomatic of a broader dynamic that you can also see in Europe, namely this idea that everything has become tribal, that we don't have to actually respect basic institutions anymore. Everything is about politics, and institutions are political by design, right? That's the idea. That's not there. In a previous world, we believe that you've got such a thing as the state, including US aid, including any other kind of operations, and the US state make sure that everything works reasonably well. And then on top of that, you've got a government who makes some political decisions on the left or on the right side of the political spectrum, whatever it is. But now, given that everything has been politicized, then all those people who are upset with how the US government has operated under Democrats, under Biden, or over the past 20 years under the establishment, deep state, whatever MAGA supporters call it, they believe that it's perfectly okay to essentially destroy those institutions. with all the kind of negative consequences that it holds. And that kind of anti-establishment thinking, like they're all corrupt, it's all a waste of money, is exactly what will, in the long term, hurt, once again, your average American, because it means that the US government will no longer be able to operate normally, not in terms of aid, not in terms of security across the seas, but also at home, right? It's basically an extreme version of starving the beast, making the government fail at every, the state fail at every level, and then say, look, the state is useless anyway, so we're going to make it fail even more.
So if we take all these things into account, right? Starving of the beast, and particularly starving the institutions that can keep the government in check, right? Annoying partners, and maybe even turning partners into foes or enemies. All the domestic consequences that we spoke about. And just in general, Trump's erratic behavior. We haven't really talked about one topic, and this is the question I want to ask you. Balder, do you think it's more or less likely now that the United States is going to start a war? Because we're going from a from that deep state, as some call it, that was somewhat warmongering. I mean, we've seen the United States foreign policy behavior over the last decades towards this uncontrolled environment with erratic behavior. So is the United States going to more or less likely start a war, potentially in Panama?
Well, and this is one of the areas where I am happy to be a little bit more optimistic. I don't know if optimistic is the right phrase, but my intuitive answer would be, actually, it's less likely. Now, this may seem weird given what we've just discussed with respect to Greenland, Denmark, Canada, Panama. But the difference is what you just hinted at. US foreign policy has always had one enormous weakness. Since the Second World War, not before, but since the 1940s, has had one enormous weakness. Namely, that they started believing that the United States, as the city on the hill, and this was shared between Republicans and Democrats at a foreign policy level, the United States being the city on the hill means that the United States has some kind of free pass to aggressively pursue a liberal democratic agenda around the globe, aggressively invade countries when they are in danger of falling to communism, or when they're sort of authoritarian dictators like Saddam Hussein that need to be removed. That kind of attitude has made the United States by far the most militarily aggressive nation over the past 80 years. This idea of, we are the policemen of liberal democracy, we know that everyone is going to become like us in the future because we have figured out the ideal balance of human governance, and therefore we can use our enormous military machine, the most powerful military machine the world has ever known, to shape the world in our image. That has been an enormous weakness of US foreign policy, and one that the Biden administration, Antony Blinken in particular, the former Secretary of State, were very, very clearly guilty of. Donald Trump doesn't have that interest of the United States being a city on the hill. Donald Trump doesn't believe that there's anything to be gained of removing dictators. What does he care about liberal democracy around the world? He is supposed to care about your average American citizen. And for your average American citizen, starting a war abroad is bad. So that is why, despite the whole posturing and the whole aggression in narrative against Denmark and sometimes weird choices that he made, for example, in his first presidency of assassinating General Soleimani from Iran, things like that, I actually believe that the United States will become less warmongering as a result of the Trump administration. Yes, lots of bluster, lots of threatening language, lots of destructive language, as we've just discussed, but not actually the step of going to war, because the Trump administration doesn't get anything out of it. Why would they?
They could get control over the Panama Canal out of it.
Right, so if they were to do that, so it's already bad that they're threatening it. If they were to actually occupy the Panama Canal, that would be an enormous blunder from Trump's perspective, because yes, okay, they could control trade in that way, but it would go put into hyperdrive those dynamics that we've just discussed. The whole world would be outraged. Nobody could look at the United States anymore in any serious, productive way. And it would actually lead to very significant cost for the Trump administration. I think the calculation for Trump right now is, I threaten it and I'm gonna create a negotiations that are on my terms. Panama is going to have to give in somehow. Just like with Canada, just like with Denmark, they're going to have to give in a little bit. But if these countries don't give in some way, then going to war or actually militarily occupying those places is going to be incredibly costly. And it's going to be very hard for Trump to actually defend that at home.
See, I agree that I think this is also just a negotiation tactic. I disagree that he knows of these costs because he's ignoring them right now, right? I mean, just the rhetoric alone is already causing enormous costs for him, as we've laid out in this episode. He hasn't cared about that at all. And I don't think he cares about what it would mean to the United States if he were to start a special military operation of simply taking back control, right? I did just in quotation marks. I feel like I should also emphasize them when I talk in a podcast format. Right? So basically taking back quotation marks, the Panama Canal. I am not so certain, right? With this, I really feel like Trump is erratic enough to go for that move. Because it doesn't mean, right, it's not about a long and costly war as in the Middle East without a clear-cut goal. No, the clear goal is to take control of the canal. You can do that with a few SEAL teams, theoretically. And then you have control over it, and you can kind of claim that at home and kind of proclaim free trade for the world. And I'm honestly not sure whether anyone in the world would actually impose sanctions on the United States as a result.
I don't know if we're there yet. The world is still trying to get their head around, wrap their head around the fact that the United States has so radically changed its identity, right? So I think there is sort of a delay in reaction from Europe, certainly. China might very much react aggressively because China would have something to say about that. Directly, I mean, in the long term, Latin America, Central America, and Europe would absolutely react, but it might take a while. Now, I accept that there is seemingly on the surface a little bit of inconsistency in what I'm saying, right? So I'm first criticizing the words that Trump is using towards these countries, and then I'm saying he's not going to be that bad. But if you look at his first presidency, what you notice is that when Trump can tweet out something, just throw something out there, badly thought out, he will do so, and it will be destructive, it will be bad. But the moment it comes to actual planning and occupying the Panama Canal, even if it's with a few special operations, it still requires significant planning and still requires him talking to his generals, talking to the Pentagon. He pulls back. Because all of a sudden, he is being told, hang on, Mr. President, it's one thing that you announce something in a press conference to the world. It's another thing that we actually have to do it. And at least if we look at his first presidency, what you see is that then he becomes very reluctant. He becomes more hesitant for the reason that I just mentioned. He is not driven by this ideological mindset. And I cannot emphasize enough how that ideological mindset was a determining factor in U.S. military action abroad over the past 80 years. The war in Iraq could never have happened without that mindset. The war in Vietnam could never have happened without that mindset. And Donald Trump doesn't have that mindset. And so now he's going to be held back at the last moment by his institutions, by his generals, by his advisors, who might actually get very concerned about the consequences.
Well, see, my concern is that because these advisors and generals held him back in the first presidency, and he removed all of them, even turning them into enemies, right? I mean, we've seen this with John Bolton's security personnel being removed, right? And he now really only has yes men around him, who are despicable human beings. I mean, the one I always mention is Stephen Miller, right, who is in charge of that migration situation, that he actually has people who are driving him to do that, who are really pushing him to do that. With the generals, it might be a little bit different, but he has basically removed everyone within the institutions that would disagree with him. And my concern is that here you don't even need ideology to justify this, right? Because if you're an intelligent person, you're against war, yes, then you need ideology to kind of convince yourself that, yes, you're doing this for the right reasons. I don't think these people have that understanding that what they would be doing is wrong.
No, so I completely buy that argument. I think you're absolutely right in the sense that it's clear that there are way more yes men around him now than in the first Trump administration. There's no doubt about that. Because in the first year, even had generals who joined the administration with the idea of, at least I can sort of be the sensible person in the room. And those are all gone. Now, as you briefly mentioned, the Pentagon itself hasn't radically been altered because that's a slow process. Trump can't just replace a general that easily. That's a very different process. But maybe I'll be wrong, right? As a foreign policy analyst, you should never make predictions. I think there is still too many costs that will be pointed out to Trump in order for him to actually go on. It in his mind and in his advisor's mind, it may make a lot of sense. Let's occupy the Panama Canal. But then someone in the CIA or someone in the Pentagon or Homeland Security is going to raise their finger and say, okay, Mr. President, but just be aware that this, and this is going to happen next. And at that moment, he will rethink things. It's interesting that you mentioned John Bolton, because John Bolton was actually a very active proponent of invading Venezuela against the Maduro regime. And the Pentagon, so Bolton was a very hawkish character in the White House during the first administration. And he desperately wants to get rid of Maduro. And then the Pentagon said, no way, invading Venezuela is not going to happen. And these are the reasons why. And Bolton in the end got kicked out and Trump followed the Pentagon. Right. So I think that it's in many ways, Trump is a lot of destructive bluster, a lot of destructive blabbing. But once it comes to actual real decision making, he has an intuitive tendency to back off because he doesn't want to risk the potential outcome.
Well, unless he's having a bad day, as we saw with Soleimani. Because I'm sure there were plenty of people in the room who told him this is a terrible idea. You're risking war with Iran.
Indeed.
And a serious escalation. And I think then only afterwards, right, in the aftermath of the back and forth between Iran and the United States, and his advisors at that time were able to kind of rein him in. But right with that, I'm a bit worried, but I really hope that you're right, and that we're not going to see an invasion or like any form of military operation of the United States against Panama.
Yeah, and obviously so do I, and maybe it's wishful thinking on my part, right? But the Soleimani example is a very good example of things going wrong. However, the assassination of one person is still very different militarily, because that only required one drone, and that was it, than actually invading the Westphalian territory of another nation, right? And in that sense, even though there is a lot of darkness at the moment around the United States, around the and inside of the White House, and there is a lot of things that should concern all of us very, very deeply, things are not looking good. And I, before recording, I told you that it's actually, for the first time in a long time, I'm actually a little bit depressed in that sense, because it seems like a glacier, where Trump is only the symptom of the glacier, that is moving in a direction that we're not controlling anymore. And basic principles and basic ideas in the world are no longer being respected, that I thought we had built up as humanity over time, and we all agreed upon. I would still like to think that at least one good thing about Donald Trump in all of this is that he doesn't have this inherent arrogance about the United States being superior. He wants the United States to be strong. He believes he's the strong leader, but it doesn't care about how other countries live their lives. And that is a very good thing after 80 years of American establishment aggressively bullying the world into becoming like themselves. And that has been gone horribly wrong. And hopefully in the next 4 years, there will be at least some improvement in that direction.
This seems like a great moment to end today's conversation on Donald Trump and what will US foreign policy look like in the next 4 years. If you have any questions, comments, or you heard a mistake that we've made throughout the episode, please make sure to send us an email to thewesternbubble@gmail.com, and we will try to incorporate them into our following episodes. Thank you very much to the listeners for joining us today. Make sure to join us again next week when we burst the Western Bubble in our 100th episode. That is it from my side. Baldur, which closing quote did you pick for us today?
Well, I never tire of quotes by the US founding fathers, who on the one hand set up this enormously sophisticated and well-designed system of checks and balances, but on the other hand, also knew the inherent fragility and weaknesses of the system they were creating. And specifically, John Adams was one of the founding fathers who was very, very keenly aware that this project might not last in the long term. And this quote from his letters clearly demonstrates this and is one that we should all be very, very aware of. And it goes, "Remember, democracy never lasts long. It soon wastes, exhausts, and murders itself. There never was a democracy yet that did not commit suicide. Passions are the same in all men, under all form of simple government, and when unchecked, produce the same effects of fraud, violence, and cruelty."